So this session is all about visualizations you can do with the JavaScript API. Now, most of the things we're going to talk about, or we're going to show you, are examples from 3x, but most of them apply to 4 or will be in 4 very shortly. So I think most of the code snippets are relatively the same for what we're going to show. So I think you can assume that this content can work basically in 3 or 4, and we'll try to let you know if it's not the case. So the feature layer is really your client, your gateway to doing client-side visualization. It connects with your service. It connects with the layer in your service and brings data down. And then when you have that data on the client, you can visualize it where it's drawn in either SVG or Canvas or the future WebGL. It's very interactive. You can do pop-ups. You can query it client-side. You can work with it. In 3x, it supports editing. Editing is not there yet in 4. But what we're really going to talk about today is the various ways you can visualize the feature layer. So we're going to really talk about the visualization techniques that you can use on the JavaScript API. Now, almost all of these that we're going to show have worked their way into the web map or as part of smart mapping. That's sort of the driver behind the types of visualizations that we try to come up with. So at first, we'll talk about some of the basic renderers. And Christian, you know, jump in at any time. A service has a default renderer. It's stored in that drawing info property on the service. That's its own defined symbology and renderer. And if you just connect directly to a service, like in this example, it's going to create that and load it in. But now we're going to talk about how you can really work with that layer and show different techniques. So let's start with the most simple thing, is just show me where something is. It's a single symbol, there's no field, this is just map of all the cities. And I've got this layer here to a layer in a map service, and creating the feature layer and setting some default symbology with just a simple renderer. Actually, this 3x code is much, much simpler in 4.
Yeah, in 4, so as you can see in the 3x code, you have a bunch of these set methods, so set size, set color, set outline. What's really nice about the 4.0 API is you don't have all those. There's just one set method, and even then you don't even have to call it directly. You can just say symbol.size and equals whatever size you want. And similarly, the constructors are much simpler. So if we were to use a single constructor to create, say, a simple marker symbol, you have simple marker symbol dot style slash solid or something like that to define the style of the symbol, whereas in 4x, you just pass a simple object into the constructor, and you can say set style and then a simple string that says solid, and it will work.
So. Yeah, definitely check out some of the 4.0 sessions to get a feel. That's under the accessor topic, basically, yeah, of how to get and set properties. Okay, so show me where. That's kind of not that interesting. Well, show me what things are. So that's your typical, you know, unique value renderer. And we have all the crimes in San Diego, and they're classified by crime type.
Yeah.
And then what you're basically doing in your code is you're creating a unique value renderer. You're going off of this type field. That's the field in your layer. And then you're just adding a set of specific types that you want to color or size or map. So these are expected to sort of be in that data, and when they come through, they're are loaded, you're going to see when it comes to an attribute that has this drugs alcohol violations, it's going to draw this symbol right here. You can even take it a step further, and let's say you don't have an attribute in your table, but you want to create something on the fly. So typically, you would have a unique value renderer where you have this particular field, like this primary care physician rate. That can be taken out and turned into a function. So here we've got the unique value renderer that takes in not a string, which represents an attribute called primary care physician rate, but actually represents a function. This function is going to get called every time the renderer is trying to draw. So when it tries to draw, it's going to get the it's going to be given the graphic that's currently trying to be drawn, and you can go in and do things. So I can take this, the value of this variable, and maybe I want to turn it into a rate. So that's what this example tries to show. And let's actually, this is better off just showing. So here we have alcoholic spending per person compared to the national average, but it allows you to make some pretty interactive applications. So it's classified it into above, below, and similar, but if I touch on a county, I can redo that with respect to this county. So how much does Kern County spend, and then how does it compare with the rest of the nation? As I click on one of these, it's going to keep recomputing that and redrawing it. So how does that actually work? Well, if we look at the source, here's my, this is the key code right here. Here's my renderer, and it's a function that's going to get called. It's going to get that value, and then we're going to compute some statistics. We're going to pick what's within 1% of that value, and we're going to call that similar. What's greater than the average percent, and we're going to call that above, and then everything else will be below. And then you have just a simple unique value renderer, above, below, similar, and it's expecting these values to come through based on that function. And then you can make it interactive by coming in, and when the user clicks on a graphic, I'm going to set the average to whatever that specific graphic is, and I'm going to redraw and refresh it. Does that make sense? Basically, you can create data that doesn't exist on your layer.
And yeah, so going back to 4.0 for unique value render, you'll notice in Jeremy's code snippet that in 3x you have to call add value several times to add different values. In 4, you don't have to do that. So
do you want to switch?
Yeah, let's go ahead and switch.
Which number are you?
5. So here I'm just showing some source code for this app, which I just have unique values for highway types in Los Angeles. And the code is a lot more slim, as you can see. So when I do my symbols, it's just a simple object again, where I say color, width, style, and I do that for each of my symbols. And then when I actually define the renderer here, I don't need to call that method a bunch of times. I can just pass in an array of objects that map the symbols to each of those unique values. So it's really nice and slim to help you when you're just creating your renders out of the box.
So. Cool. And here's the code snippet for how we're computing that, what I just showed you in that sample. Okay, now let's move from the show me what things are to the show me how much is there. And we're going to spend quite a bit of time on this section. It can be based off of a field value or an expression or a function, actually. We'll talk about expression in a little bit. We deal with color, size, opacity. So these are really parametric properties that are available to you on the renderer that control basically the symbols that are drawn. You can control rotation, size, color, opacity, all with these info objects. Rotation info, size info, color info, and opacity. Those are what we term as visual variables. Basically, you're going to take data and you're going to apply it to those symbol properties. You might take a heading and apply that to how the symbol should be rotated. Or I might take population total of a feature and apply that to how it should be sized. Now you can still do the traditional classed version. So show me how much. So here we have a class breaks renderer. So what a class breaks renderer does is basically takes your data and breaks it up into however many classes you want, and you have different statistical techniques to choose from of how you want to break that up. Now, typically, if you're writing in code itself, you would have come up with the classes somehow beforehand. Maybe you use Pro or ArcMap to figure out what the classes are, or maybe you use the service generate renderer to come up with that, or maybe use some of the smart mapping functions. But basically, you have a class breaks renderer with a default symbol, and then the field that you want to map, this college degrees, and you're going to add specific breaks. 0 to 3.499 is going to be this symbol. 3.5, this symbol, and so forth. And basically, when it goes to draw, it's going to figure out which bucket it flies in, and it's going to give it that color or that particular symbol. Now, an alternative method is to do continuous ramp, continuous color. This is driven by that color info object that we were talking about. So here's a map of the acres of harvested cropland as a percentage of the land and farms acreage. And so it goes from 0 to 100. We see areas of dark brown have a very high percentage of the county is farmland, and areas in yellow is a very low percentage. Now notice there's not five particular classes here. There's lots of, actually each individual value gets its own color wherever that lies on the ramp. And the way that's driven is with the color info visual variable. So here we've got the color info visual variable. This is the field that we're working with. And we have this notion called stops. And what stops allows you to do is to take a particular data value that you have and apply it to a particular color. Or actually, I said that wrong. Take a particular color that you want to see and apply it to some data value. So in this first example, a value of 10 is going to get this color, which would be white, which I think is not exactly what you see on the map, but imagine it's yellow. And then the value of 90 is going to get this other color, which might be like, let's say, brown. Now, what happens if the value is below 10? Well, what this does is it says if the value is 10 or below, it's going to be this color. If it's 90 or above, it's going to be this color. And you can put as many stops in here as you want. You could make it actually stretch through the whole range of the data if you wanted to. What we call this is bounded proportional symbols. Basically, we're bounding the outliers so that they don't drive the ramp or desaturate the ramp. It allows you to also easily showcase different examples. So this is with you want to tie the ramp to a particular data value. So this is a retail spending potential, and areas that are white are match the national average. Areas that are blue are below the national average, and areas in red are above the national average. So what this, how visual variables with color info, how you can set that is basically you decide what are the breakpoints are. So we're going to say anything below 2684, we're going to call blue. Anything up until 22,000, we're going to call white. Anything in between, we're going to scale proportionally from blue to white. Then we're going to say, hey, anything above 83,000 is going to be red, and anything in between the 22,000 and 83,000 is going to scale proportionally from white to red. Why this is important is that it allows you to take real data, our important real numbers, and map it. So maybe it's the national average. Maybe it's a value that's an important value, like income. What's an important value that Jim would always say? Like it's a known value that you want to map to. You know, anything above 10% poverty is too much and triggers other things. So you want to set that breakpoint at that 10% value. And this is showing an above and below theme, but we're just doing it by three colors here. Let's talk about size. You have lots of different ways you can symbolize data with size. You can use the actual area that might be present in the data to size things. So in this case, this is a map of tree campings in Warren Wilson College. It's a visual variable of size info. There's a field in that layer called ground area, and its units are in feet, and it represents an aerial unit. And so what it's going to do is going to make sure that that always draws correctly at whatever scale you are at. I think if this sample is working. So notice as I zoom in, those circles are going to just keep getting bigger because they're drawing at true scale. As I zoom out, they're going to get smaller and smaller because at this scale, that area represents a tiny fraction of what's on the screen. Make sense? Now, you can also do truly proportional size symbols. And what do I mean by truly proportional? By truly proportional, we mean if this value is 100 and it's size 5, and this value is 200, it shall be size 10. Basically, it's truly proportional with the data. When you set this up, you would basically set up what's the min data value that you're interested in looking at, and what is the min size that you want to go with. So this is the smallest value in this data set is 5,000, and so 5,000 is going to be a size 1, and it's going to just scale proportionally. Now, the challenge you get with truly proportional maps is if your data spans many different magnitudes, then you're going to end up with some very, very large sizes. It's going to be too big to draw. This is sort of a traditional cartographic technique, proportional symbol maps. And what's important to just remember, even just going back a little bit on why this color option is an option today, is to think about sort of like the history of cartography. So with cartography, cartography was designed for printed maps. Thematic cartography is designed for printed maps. So when you have a printed map, you need to be able to have someone look at the map and then look at the legend and know exactly where something falls. So what are the techniques you've learned? You learned, okay, well, people can't really see more than 8 colors, so let's do no more than 8 classes. And that way we're assured that someone can look at the color on the printed map and then go over to the legend and say, oh, okay, this 36.4 to 48.5 is this color, so that's why I know what the value is on this map. In the digital world, you still have a legend, but the legend is more of a sort of an overview. And what that allows you to do is to actually do these kind of continuous mappings. You're not relying on the user to specifically find a color on the screen and then find it in that legend. If the user wants to know what the value of something is, they just touch the map and it tells them exactly what that value is. So we can embrace the digital world, where most things are digital and interactive, and use some of these techniques. And why it's interesting to look at these techniques and to use them is it's actually much more logical and much simpler to do this than to create a classified map. If you think about a classified map, it's a very complicated, or it requires a lot of in-depth knowledge about what you're doing. You need to know, first, how many classes do you want to break it up? Do you want to do 3 classes? Do you want to do 8 classes? Why do I do 8 versus 9? And then the next question you have to ask yourself is, out of those 8 classes, how do you want to statistically break up your data so that it falls within those classes? Do you want to use something called natural breaks? Do you want to use something called equal intervals, standard deviation? You've got to sort of taken a cartography class at least to understand that. In this continuous realm, you don't need to do that, basically. You need to decide how you want to apply color to values to your data and then just let it interpolate out. And if they want to find something, what the detail of something is, they just touch it and it'll tell them. That's what the pop-ups are for. Anything you want to add, Christian?
No, I think you covered it pretty well.
So going back to this map, truly proportional size, this is also a typical printed cartographic map technique, right? You would have the circles on the map, and then you would look in the legend, and you would sort of compare the size of the circle that you saw on the map with what's on the legend, and that would tell you that size or that matching up would tell you what those values are. But you can also use the notion of bounded proportional. So this is a technique where you basically don't let the outliers drive the size. You set some limits on what those sizes are. So here, I've got a value of 0 is going to be 4, but anything more than this 10 million number is going to be size 50. And we'll just let that be the maximum size. The reason this is a popular technique is it allows you to sort of constrain the effect of the outliers on your map. And this is a perfect example of why you'd really want to do this. So let's look at not just sizing of markers, but also sizing the width of lines. So this is traffic in Florida on the average daily traffic count. And what we see is that we have on a min size of 1 and a max size of 10. And we want it to go from 1,000 to 100,000. So this is another way to specify this, not through stops, but by explicitly setting the sizes that you want and the data values that you want. So anything less than 1,000 is going to get a size 1. Anything more than 100,000 is going to get a size 10. Now, another technique, especially when you start dealing with sizing and sizing markers, is that typically only works good at one scale. And as you zoom out or zoom in, those sizing values are going to potentially clutter your map. As you zoom out, they're going to get too big, and as you zoom in, they're going to get too small. And so, go to the sample. So what we see here is this is the average farm expenses by a county, and we're drawing a marker for each county. And as I zoom in, notice that legend getting bigger. We're going to keep growing the sizes based on whatever scale you're at. So it's always a fairly good-looking map. And as you zoom out, we'll even notice that at some point, see how the outlines of those counties are getting dimmer and dimmer? Those will eventually go away, and you just have the markers.
That's something you can do directly in code, but it is a lot easier to just set that in ArcGIS Online. You bring the layer in, and there's a little checkbox. I believe it's checked by default, correct?
Yep.
So it'll when you save the render to the layer, it'll automatically use this technique so that the layer looks good at all scales. But you can also do it directly in code.
Yeah, which is what this sample does. So it's a little bit more complicated here. We've got a visual variable size info. It's got a min data value of 0, max data value of like 2.6 million. And we notice that min size and max size are no longer specific numbers, like pixels. They're actually an object of another size info. And in this size info, we've introduced the notion of an expression, and this will be coming out more later. But basically, the expression is, well, tell me what the scale is for this particular view. So this view.scale, every time this thing draws, view.scale is going to be populated. And then what we've got here are actual scale values. So if the scale is 1,100, then it's going to be size 16. If the scale is this really big number, if it's a very small scale, it's going to be size 2. So we're basically varying what the min size will be based on the scale of the map at the time it's drawn, and doing the same thing on the max size. You can apply this also to the outline. So in this case, we have a visual variable of size info that targets the outline of that polygon. But with the same expression, view.scale, and I'm going to change those sizes of the outline from 2 to 1 to 0. So this is more involved in terms of the amount of code you write, and then it's more like trial by error if you were to do it by hand on what are the sizes that look good. But as Christian will show you later, the smart mapping modules help give you a renderer that looks pretty good for based on your data. You can also use opacity. Opacity is, you've got RGB and then transparency or opacity. You can control, you can let data drive what the opacity is. So here's a map of precipitation index. It's basically all blue, but I think a code snippet here. We're going to let the precipitation index drive the opacity of the color. So this opacity, so between min data value of 0 and max data value of 10, it's going to go between 0 and 1. This could also be stops, where the value and opacity are members of those objects. And I think that's what's in the samples, actually. What's another case where you might want to use opacity? Here's an example of a map that shows you the predominant crop grown in each county. So we see the red polygons are vegetables in terms of they're grown the most here. The Orange is corn, the blue is soybeans, the purple is wheat, the green is cotton. But this is kind of a misleading map, because you look at this map, you see what's the most common type of crop grown. But they're not really equal, because I see Las Vegas is a full color and grows vegetables there. But if you actually were to click on the Las Vegas county, you would see that there's 30 acres of vegetables grown and nothing else. Whereas if you go over here in the Midwest, you're going to see hundreds of thousands of acres grown of corn. So how you can use opacity to tell you something about what's going on is you can use opacity to diminish things that have very small values. So now we're letting opacity be driven by the total number of the percent of farmed land for that county. So a value of 10, which for this data set is minus one standard deviation, we're going to say it's completely transparent. A value of 39, which is the average value, 39 is the average value for this data set, we're going to say it's a half opaque. And then a value of 68, which is plus one standard deviation, we're going to say it's fully opaque. And there's quite a massive difference between this map and this map in terms of what it communicates to the user. Anything you want to add?
It's all about getting the story right and telling it to the audience. Both maps are technically accurate. I mean, there's nothing that just overtly is, I guess, lying to you in the first map. But as Jeremy said, it is misleading at the same time, because in Clark County, Nevada, that is the dominant crop in the area. But what kind of message are you trying to convey? That's just something to keep in mind. And the visual variables really make that simple for you to incorporate into your application. So.
And in this case, we're taking a combination of show me what and show me how much.
Right.
And we're combining them. So we're really doing bivariate mapping two things at the same time to tell a better story. And you can do that all over the place, showing potential correlation. You can do two or more variables on the map based on what you're visualizing. Christian, why don't you talk about this map?
All right, yeah, this is a map of education where actually, so there's two variables, right?
Do you want me to go to the...
Yeah, go ahead and show the snippet. So okay. The size info, so is showing the percentage of adults in each county that finished college. So they completed either an associate's, bachelor's degree, or higher. And you can similarly add another numeric attribute to see if there is a potential for correlation in some areas. And so I decided to do political affiliation. So if they are registered Republicans, you can set a number of stops that say based on, and then shade each icon based on that percentage. So if we go back to show the full map, you can see in the northeast there in New England, there's deep color, which will show that there are a high number of, I guess the Republican must be the lighter color, and Democrat is the darker color.
Yep.
And you'll see there's a lot of people, or a higher percentage of people, who finished college in that area, but they also tend to be Democratic. But that's not true of everywhere in the U.S. You can see areas there in the Midwest where you have a lot of people who finished college, but they identify as Republican. And same in the Atlanta area. So you want to be careful with how you communicate this sometimes, because you can... also provide misleading messages even with a cool looking map, because you don't want to say that people who finish college are always tend to be Democratic. And that's why the map is awesome, because it can show you that that's true in some areas, but it's also not true in others. It's quite the opposite, actually. So
and it really shows how you can drive multiple visual variables based on your data. And this is used extensively in ArcGIS Online as part of smart mapping. You can easily add another variable, and it comes to life for you. Something we just added was the ability to show me when things occurred. What does when mean? That means what are the dates or what time did a feature come to life? What time was the data collected? What time was the stop sign serviced? How long did it take for the stop sign to be serviced from when someone reported that it was knocked over? We have two new styles, timeline with the start and basically a continuous color timeline where you can look at color from when it started, when the data started to when it ended. And or you can look at it in terms of before and after. You can say before and after a specific date, what happened, and let me change the colors based on that. So here's an example of when roads were serviced or how recent they were serviced. And what we're saying is that basically the last maintenance field is a date field, and we're saying the maintenance date of which is this number right here, we're going to call that white, and we're going to say today is going to be blue. So the this maintenance date might be the minimum date in that data set, so July 25th, 2013. So,
or it could be any other meaningful date, say that you have a policy to service within 3 years or something.
Yep. And so areas in white were serviced a long time ago. Areas in blue or purple were serviced much more recently. Mm-hmm. You can also even take this a step further and do age. So let's say you have a data set that has a 311 call date and then a 311 resolve date, and you want to create a map of all the incidents and what was the age or how long did it take from that start to that finish for each feature, and then map that with color or size. It's also possible. Now we'll spend a little bit of time talking about some of the other renderers that are available to you. So we did sort of your traditional simple class breaks, unique value. We showed you how you can augment that with visual variables and let visual variables drive the color, size, opacity. But there's this, another set of renderers that you can look at. One is dot density. And a dot density renderer basically draws dots equal to the whatever the value is that you're mapping, and you can map multiple variables. So this is a map of a Southern California Asian population. I think this is by census tract, I think.
Tract, yeah.
So basically it's a feature layer of census tracts where there's an attribute for the number of Chinese, number of Japanese, number of Korean, Filipino, Vietnamese. And you give each of those columns basically a color, and then you set some bounds on how many dots you want. And the renderer will draw that many dots based on whatever the value is. So here, create the dot density renderer, set the fields that I'm looking at. Chinese is going to be this color, Japanese this color, and so forth. And we're going to say that the dot size is going to be 2, and the dot value is 100. So that means if let's say there were 500 Chinese, you would get 5 dots of size 2 at that color. And you can go crazy. You can say that each dot can be 1-to-1 with its value. So this is a map of, This is a map of corridor in Southern California along Wilshire Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard, and basically I think it's showing renters and people who rent, people who own, and people or houses that are vacant. So red is renting, blue is owned, and green over here is vacant. So this is a good way for someone to actually look at the distribution of multiple things at the same time to sort of see the level of density. One challenge you get with dot density maps is people sort of put too much emphasis on where the dots are. And and start to say, hey, no, there's no dot over here. You know, that no, that's not true. But really, these are just random dots placed within these polygons. Anything else to say on dot density?
Oh, yeah, that's the main thing to keep in mind, is the dots aren't literal.
The dots aren't literal, yes. yeah.
But they do a good job of showing density, though, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a pretty neat technique to visualize data. We haven't exposed it in ArcGIS Online yet, so. But I imagine we will at some point. Another one renderer that's kind of along the similar lines is something we call a blend renderer. And what this shows is that same area along Wilshire Boulevard, but we're showing red is renter occupied, blue is owner occupied, and green is vacant. And we're letting the dominant color have the most opacity. So what we say here is that in this blend renderer, we're going to say that the owner occupied is going to get a full color of blue, renter occupied is going to get a full color of red, and vacant's going to get a green. But we're going to set opacity stops that apply to all three of these fields at the same way. So we say anything anything with a value of 0.1 is going to be completely transparent, and anything with a value of 1 is going to be fairly opaque. And we're normalizing based on the total number of people who live there. So this gives you the percentage of owner, percentage of renter, percentage of vacant. If the percentage of owner is quite high, it's going to get a much stronger color. And that's where you're going to get these darker blues and darker reds.
Yeah, this is very much about predominance. In this case, the value is coming from it's taking the predominant field and then normalizing it and using that value to set the opacity. So that's where that value comes from.
And some people have used it to make some fairly clever or unique maps. This is showing predominant minority population by county. So the areas in red are Native American, pink and purple are Asian, blue is African American, and green is Hispanic. You could also do this same map with dot density.
Yep.
And might give you a slightly different feel. You can also do heat map renderer. Heat map renderer basically takes your data, finds the density, and draws it in a stronger color. One challenge with heat map renderer is it's very scale dependent. So where you set those parameters, it might look good at that scale, but as you zoom out, they're going to get it's all in map space. Screen space. So as you zoom out, everything's going to start to be cold. And as you zoom in, everything's going to be no. Sorry, as you zoom out, everything's going to be hot because the data becomes smaller and smaller in area. But since it's all in screen space, it's going to have very strong colors. And as you zoom in, everything's going to get cold because the screens. You've zoomed into an area where there's just a few features and you end up with these little halos, circles around it. I was never a big fan of the heat map renderer, but we did it. But there are cases where it can really help you understand help your users understand the data better. And that's in the area of if you have a lot of overlapping features.
Yeah.
So something like earthquakes. If you looked at all the earthquakes in the U.S., you would see, dots all over the place. But it's hard to sort of tell areas that have a lot of dots, a lot of earthquakes, because you're looking at it at the world scale. And what's pretty amazing is if you bring a data set in, like earthquakes, and do a heat map on it, well, actually, you're going to see areas of the world that are having a lot of earthquakes right now. So, like Oklahoma and Kansas have a lot of earthquakes potentially related to fracking. You totally miss out on that if you're just looking at the points, because all the points are sort of drawn on top of each other. But if you turn that into a heat map, that density comes alive and you can really see it.
And you can also base that on a field, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to see the density of earthquakes based on say magnitude, where the magnitude makes the influences the density even more. You could do that.
All right.
Well, let's see if this is good. All right. So as Jeremy went over that, some of you might have thought, well, that's really cool. We can set these renders easily, use visual variables, but some of the values might look kind of arbitrary, and you might wonder, how in the world do you know which values to use? There's a lot of, guesswork involved in that sometimes. And so that's why we released Smart Mapping. And Smart Mapping is really all about letting data drive your visualization. Some of you may know it was released early last year with our 3.13 release of the API. We now recently, just last week, released 3.17. And there have been smart mapping improvements and additions in each of the subsequent releases since 3.13. But what really makes smart mapping nice is it really takes the guesswork out of those values, because you're letting the statistics of your data drive what stops you should be using. So, and it also selects good defaults. And a lot of times it's just hard to select a good color ramp. But with smart mapping, we have built in good color ramps that are used, that it chooses based on the base map that you might be using. So it won't put a light green to dark green color ramp on top of satellite imagery, because that won't look very good. It will choose a ramp for you that's good. It also will set good outlines and background fill outlines based on the scale of your data, so that makes it kind of nice. Also, the opacity to use in each color, and sizes for your lines and the outlines of your markers.
Hey, Christian, maybe I'll show a quick demo of how it's used in ArcGIS Online. So here I've got a county data set of voting patterns, and I can go ahead in here and map things. Like, maybe I want to map the party affiliation, people who declare themselves as Republican. Okay, so what did I do there? You know, I got a fairly good looking map. What this is a simple renderer with a color info visual variable, where we're driving we're driving how the color is applied to the data set by the statistics of the data set. So that's really, like Christian said, really looking into the data set to drive that. Now, when you look at something like this, which is a count, you basically just see areas of high population. But you can divide by, let's say, the number of people who actually vote and see, it's definitely data driven. I see this nice histogram. The average is 49% of people who vote and who have voted in the last year and declare themselves Republican. And we're saying that this happens to be one standard deviation, 55%. So we're going to give that a color of dark brown, and anything more than that's going to have the same color. This is 44%. That's minus one standard deviation. We're going to go the other direction and say that anything lower than that's just going to be yellow. It's base map aware. And not at this level. It's base map aware, so picking different base maps based on what color ramp looks good for that base map, and so on. You can also drive, well, let's just go back to this for a second. It looks like a bug. You can also have it be driven by size. What the heck's going on here? Come on. There we go. And this sizing the marker based on the number of people. So this is a size info that's being applied. Basically, we also look at the average area of the feature so that we can get 75% of the feature on average filled up with a marker. So that's the sizes will always be different based on the data that you're looking at. And if I come back to here and say, let me normalize by the number of people who voted, and I get this very nice normal distribution, but I have control here to say, well, what is it at 50%? So here we say everything smaller than, everything that's small is 50% or less, and then everything above that is sized proportionally. So showing you really what are the very major Republican counties in the, across the U.S. I can add multiple variables. So maybe I want to do... those who attended a political rally or a protest. And what we'll see here is now I can mess with color or size. I can control that. So let's do color, and then let's say, well, let's just keep it focused on who's voting. And let's go above and below. Now let's go back to the size and change it back to who's, so number of people who associate themselves with Republican, and let's move it back to the average. And now we've got a pretty nice map. So areas, large circles are active Republican voters who attend rallies. Large circles are active Republican voters. Red circles are active Republican voters who attend rallies, so like they're really active. Green, it means they don't attend rallies as often, but they, and if they're still big, they still might be a Republican voter. So here we've applied two of those variables, and if we were to save this out, what you would see is a color info and a size info, and those breaks would be just like what you see here, and you use those smart mapping tools to discover that. So maybe Christian can talk about smart mapping tools.
Yeah. So that's built directly into the API, and that's what the ArcGIS Online map viewer is using. So as you can tell, like it makes for some great a great way for exploring your data if you're not familiar with it. But just also note that this is mainly used for authoring your data. And I'll show you an app that you can take a look at how that might work in a custom application. So let's take a look at some of the components. There are styles that you can reference in the API. So here there are core plus styles where if you request them based on a certain base map for your map, it'll give you some schemes, style schemes that can use. And that's what smart mapping is using internally. And this is the feature layer statistics is a plugin as well in the API, and this is what I really feel is like the heart and soul of smart mapping. It's what makes it really nice to use, because if you don't know your data very well, this is the module that really helps you understand it through statistics. So if you take a look within the module, you have various methods. You have the get field statistics, and that basically calculates statistics like within the field. So it'll take a look at all the features and give you key statistics. So what is the average? What are the standard deviations? Or what's the standard deviation? And the count, total count. Things like that will help drive the visualization and give you a good default. It may not be what you end up using to author your map. You may be looking for something a little different, but it's a really good starting point for you. You can also, there's convenient methods like getting all the unique values in a certain layer or generating the histogram.
It also takes into account whatever definition expression you might have set on your feature layer, any time extent, I believe. And it also works not just with feature layers that work with a layer in a map service or a layer in a feature service. Also works with feature layers that are driven from a feature collection, so by value. So it's a very powerful API, actually. And when working with the service, not all services have the same capabilities. So the API, this method normalizes that and does different techniques for you. So let's say some services don't have the ability to return the statistics. So it does a sample, and then it would let you know that it's with sampled data. It also samples the features so that it can compute what's the average area. That's not an API that's on the service. All of these techniques are really needed to drive the what Christian's going to show you next, which is the actual smart mapping methodology.
Yeah, and so this is the smart mapping module, or the documentation for it. And this is the high-level API that you can use to create or generate renders based on your data. So if you look at the documentation for, say, creating a color render, you just want to create a simple render that has a continuous color ramp. You can see how simple it is. All you have to do is pass in your base map, and you can just do that using the map.getBaseMap method. Give it the field you're working with and the layer, and then you have the other optional parameters there as well. But really all you have to do is pass in those three things, and you'll get back an object with the statistics and a render, and you can just set that render directly on the layer. So I'll go ahead and show you this app that I built, which uses the smart mapping module to create a color renderer. And it does this all on the fly, and it's using the statistics to drive good visualizations. And so before I get into that app, just to show you what it looks like. And these are all static methods, so you call the create color renderer method on the smart mapping module, and then you pass in the layer you're working with, and then the field name. And in this case, you can see that there's an attribute dropdown that I have, and so that field name actually comes from that dropdown value. And then there's a normalized field name, which I'm using to normalize my data so it's not skewed in any way. And then pass in the base map and then an optional theme. And when this promise resolves, the object contains that render, and it's as simple as just calling layer.setRender, and you pass that render in, and it will update in the map. So I'll go ahead and show you this app in action. So here we're just looking in the Seattle area. These are block groups, and we're looking at some key demographics. And this app, really, the main purpose of it is just to explore the data. I don't want to save any rendering information to the layer because it's not really needed for my purposes. So this could be for anyone, say, in sales or real estate or anything else where demographic data might be useful. So this service, so you might wonder, well, if smart mapping is already built in ArcGIS Online, as Jeremy showed, it's really got a nice UI, and you can explore it and get a render in just a matter of a couple of minutes. Why build your own custom app that uses it if that app already does? And this app kind of shows why you might want to do that. ArcGIS Online is great when you have a number of data sets. It has a number of different functionalities, but let's say you work with one data set a lot and you already know the attributes you want to work with. You don't necessarily care about a lot of them. So this particular service has more than 60 attributes, but let's say I only care about 10 or 12. And so I can set a drop-down which will limit to those 10 or 12 that I care about. ArcGIS Online will give you all of the meaningful ones, and so I don't want to have to scroll through all of them. So for my users, I'm just going to give them these attributes that they say they care about. So let's say I want to know the adult population with a college degree. So the smart mapping module will take that field once that value changes and regenerate the render on the fly and change it. And I've even added this color info slider. We have color info slider and a size info and opacity that you can plug in to your render. And so when you update the slider, it will update the render as well on the fly. Again, it can be really nice for data exploration. And I've also added the base map toggle just to show, similar to ArcGIS Online, you can regenerate the render based on the base map. And as Jeremy said, it takes the definition expressions into account. So this is a data set that covers, I believe, most of King County, Washington. But you may not care about all of the areas in the county. So I have preset definition expressions and set those values to these dropdowns. So if I only care about the city of Seattle, I'll regenerate the render for just the city of Seattle. And or I could do attribute queries to similarly do that. So where the median home value is over $500,000. So you can still do that in ArcGIS Online, but this saves the users several clicks to get there. You have to click on the definition expression, and it takes a few clicks to actually set it, and then you apply it to the layer, and then you have to go back into the smart mapping to do it. So this is a simpler workflow. It's more focused, and if you say have one or two or three or four queries that or definition expressions that are common for the user, you can just add them in a drop down like that. Something else that's really cool about this application, in my opinion, is that it takes normalization into account behind the scenes for the user. In ArcGIS Online, you have to select the attribute, and then you have to go in and select the normalize by attribute. So here I selected the population 25 and older who have a college degree, but normalizing that by total population doesn't really make sense. You need to normalize it based on the total population 25 or older. And so I wrote a simple function that handles that based on what I'm selecting here, because there are several different, I have household income, I have number of homes, and other attributes where that same normalization field doesn't make sense. But I already know what normalization field makes sense based on what they select. I don't want to have to make them do that for them. And I can show you what that looks like in the code as well. But let's say I want to look at the college degree, and I go to an area like Sammamish, and I zoom in, and I have this really dark visualization. It looks like most of the adults there have degrees, but I want to get some more detail. You can also add custom functions in a data exploration app, like filter by map extent, and it will filter those features and regenerate the layer based on that extent. And you'll see the statistics on the side here, the histogram update, so that the white features are areas where less than 70% of the adults earned a college degree, and the darker ones are where more than 85% or 90% did. So you can do some pretty cool things customly with the smart mapping module. So if I were to look at the source code here, I'll just show you a couple of these functions. So let me blow this up so you can see it better. This is the slider I'm setting up. It's, as you can see, I just set the min and max values there. But this is the function I was talking about before, where I can get the normalization field based on what they select as the field. So if I say, if this has anything to do with household income, I want to normalize by the total number of households. And then similarly, if it's about home value, I want to do it based on the number of owner-occupied homes. I don't necessarily care about the renter-occupied. Or a college degree, it's the total population 25 and older, or total population if it's anything else. So that's one less UI element that you would have to worry about. You just handle it for your users. And then there's this update smart mapping module, which is basically called every time something is updated, the base map, the fields, the slider, and it makes this smart mapping call and updates the render. So I pass in my layer and my field name and normalized field name, and then I just set that render back on the layer. And I'm also using that plugin for generating feature layer statistics to get the histogram, because I want to use that histogram and set it back on the slider. So that's just to give you an idea of some of the things you can do with smart mapping and building a custom data exploration app. Now, something to keep in mind is that there's a certain cost to using the smart mapping module, because it...
Wait a minute. We should probably save. We should reorder that. But basically, all of those sliders are available in the API, free to use. You can use them like Christian did in his application, but they're all the ones that drive the smart mapping interface to let people control, both for classed, like that second row, last one on the right, or for continuous.
Yep. All right. And you can see the different styles there, like above and below, and using extremes. And I actually have that built into the application as well, where I allow them to say, I want to see the extremes, and they can alter the values there. So So it's pretty handy. So as I said, so the goal of smart mapping is to get you the best possible visualization based on your data. Just remember that it can be expensive because you're making a call, especially when it's a service, making a call to the service to get the statistics to introspect your data. So this is not something you would typically use in any production app. Most of the time, you're probably going to have a render saved directly to the service and just have that same visualization used across the apps in your platform. This is more, again, for data exploration. And if you want to simplify the experience for the user so they don't have to go into ArcGIS Online every time, you can build them a simple app like that. And then smart mapping lets you generate the render that you use in your application. And as Jeremy demoed a little earlier, the authoring experience in ArcGIS.com, it uses the smart mapping behind the scenes to give you that that nice experience for setting a render on your layer.
Yeah, one thing to call out what Christian was saying here. The 4.0 API makes it really easy to... back up a second. So you can go into ArcGIS.com. You can set up that map however you want, your web map. You can save it, and you can bring that web map into your application. That's been in the API for many years now to be able to read that web map. And that's the easiest case. But the problem with the web map is that it really is a map per application. But let's say you want to really use ArcGIS Online to create different layers or different views, visualizations, but just work with those layers in your applications. That's also possible with 4.0 API. where is it?
Which one are you looking at?
The portal. Yeah, create layer from portal item. Let's look at this in the sandbox. So in the 4.0 API, if we look at the code here on the left, there's the ability to load the layer from a portal item. And this portal item is just a layer that was saved in ArcGIS Online or your own portal. And that allows you to use the authoring experience of ArcGIS Online, get your layer looking exactly how you want it, save it, and then you can just bring that layer into your application later. This was kind of a pretty broad tour of all the different visualization techniques that you have available to you with the JavaScript API. We think we have a pretty sweet API and platform for being able to create these pretty sophisticated mapping visualizations. And we're always trying to improve it. And there's also a 3D session that you're doing with Kelly.
Yeah, we're doing a 3D session in the same room at 1 o'clock. So we'll go over the 4.0 API and how you can create 3D visualizations with 4.0.
Yeah.
So I encourage you to come out to that as well. Something else I wanted to show you, and I'll also show it at that. Session as well is when you go to the 4.0 API in the sample code. So if you want to explore a visualization in 4.0, you can just go to the samples and then click visualization, and the first option is get started with visualization. This goes over both 2D and 3D. So you can see options for 2D visualization and then as well as 3D. So I encourage you guys to go and read through that and take a look at the samples there as well.
And a lot of the stuff, even though it is 4.0, covers a lot of the things we already talked about.
Yeah, it's very similar in a lot of ways. So
so with that, we have a few minutes for questions. Anybody? I think most of the samples are SDK. Maybe we could get some of these up.
The last sample, the Seattle sample, is on GitHub on my repo, Esri.js samples. There's a bunch of, most of these are visualization samples. Some of them deal with other things. But if you go to my username is Ekinus, and then Esri.js samples, and then smart mapping, you'll see the smart mapping samples in there. But the ones that Jeremy was showing, most of those are in the SDK, and we link to those in the slides, and those slides will be up.
We could do, maybe we should move that one where you're, the function one where you're moving the, when you click, it changes the map.
Yeah.
Move that to your sample set.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I'll add that as well into the, probably not the smart mapping, but it'll be in here. I also have, after the conference, I'll update another repo I have for conferences. There's going to be a folder here for UC 2016, so just look in that folder, and you'll see the samples in there. Cool. Yep. Yes.
Can you use these renders with fields from related tables or a join in the workspace, like a dynamic layer?
Absolutely. And I do have a sample for that as well.
You have a blog post too,
right? And a blog post. So if you go to just Google, let's see, smart mapping, ArcGIS blog, join. Let's see if that, yeah. Is this wrong? Yeah. So I wrote this blog post just last month, actually, and that's using smart mapping in dynamic workspaces. And I go through step by step on setting up the join, and then calling smart mapping and setting the render on that join. So you can look at the live sample. So this is, again, a dynamic layer, and it has, you know, multiple sublayers, but I care about the states layer. And I have a join with a table called ancestry. And basically, it will take values from that join table and use those in smart mapping. So if I want to see any other field, I can map it that way. So this is a great resource, and as well as
the, yeah, this requires dynamic dynamic layers capability on your map service, and the map service currently doesn't support the visual variables, but it will at, it should at 10.5.
Yes, that's
so
that's
it's
true.
More of your traditional class breaks render or unique value render that you can do.
Yeah, so this is calling a classed color render instead of the continuous color. So that's just something to keep in mind for now.
All the colors that are in ArcGIS Online are in the JavaScript API. Oh yeah. Do you want to show your JSON? Extracting the JSON.
No. The playground.
No.
Oh, that's the other sample, or
yeah, the one where you steal the JSON from the web map. You have a sample for that?
I have the one where I take it from the smart mapping, like the crops, but I...
Okay, yeah, try that one.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's go back to this repo. I think it's in smart... No, it's not in smart mapping.
Here, while you're doing that, I'll show one thing. So one other thing that... let me just... save this web map. So what you're going to see is when you save the web map in online, and if you actually look at the JSON, so and you would basically close this. Okay. So this is the web map. The drawing info is on this layer definition. It's got a renderer, let's see, with multiple visual variables. So it's a class breaks renderer with a background fill symbol, and it's got multiple visual variables here. One's this color info, which is being normalized, normalizing that one field and setting those values. And the other is size one, and we're sizing those. We see the stops. Basically, you could take this JSON, this renderer, and create a renderer in the JavaScript API with it. It's basically the same. It is the same. And,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, and then there you go.
So here I, just to show you the code, it's really, really tiny app. I'm just creating a simple map and then have a layer, and I just set those default parameters to field, base map, and then I call the create color renderer, and then I am just printing out the JSON to the console. So if you want to use that later, you can use the JSON in your renderer. So.
Cool. Anybody else? Yeah, sharing slash rest slash content slash items, and then item ID, and then slash data, and question mark f equals JSON. Now, if you just open up the dev console and look at the network tab, you'll see that request being made when you load a web map, and that's basically where it is. Yep. Web map, yep.
Which sort of just triggered a thought, and the reason it did is that you have geospatial data that's not in Esri. So, can I make the assumption that as long as I produce a JSON object, like I see there, the map will render it? Like if I say create a layer based on this JSON result, then
yeah, if you follow the web map spec, which just finally got updated on the developer site, the developer site, developers at ArcGIS.com web map specification gives the full JSON spec of the web map. And so if we were to look in here, like... all the objects and color.
Not so much talking about the renderer side of it. What I'm talking about is, let's say I have an application that we flat-long information, and I just want to put those points onto a map.
Mm. Yeah, easy. You can. The web map supports a CSV layer or a GRSS layer. Or KML. So CSV would be the easiest if you just put that on a web server. Basically, it will look for the lat-long fields and add it. So basically, I can go in here and say, add from web. And one of the options is a CSV file. Enter the URL to that, and it'll look for latitude, longitude, and just draw it. And then you can do all the smart mapping that you saw.
You could also create a client-side feature layer. And then if you do that, you can access smart mapping if you wanted to.
Yeah. Or you could implement the feature service spec, which is would be how we query for data. Cool. I think it's time's up, but stop by at the island, and thank you all for coming.